Welcome to Chapter 4 on Mutual Funds, Investments for the Masses. This is arguably the most important chapter, and why is that? Because chances are, dear students, that no matter where you work, you're going to be offered an employer-sponsored plan, assuming it's a company that treats their employees well, relatively well. And the choices of those employer-sponsored plans are virtually all mutual funds. Some of them have the ability to choose individual stocks and bonds, but that's the exception, not the norm. So that's one of the reasons that we put mutual funds before we go into depth about stocks and bonds. There are two ways of teaching this class. Some people put mutual funds after going through stocks and bonds and other investment alternatives, and some people put them before. I like to put them before because, as we said, chances are you're going to be investing in them. And we hope that you've taken the material in Chapter 1 to heart, the discussion of risk versus return, because we're going to intersperse that throughout the rest of the semester, and certainly in this presentation, these presentations for mutual funds. So let's get started with slide number 2. What is a mutual fund? Well, to review, it's an investment company. That's the legal term, and you won't hear that unless you work in the industry. But that's a better term, in my humble opinion. I mean, you want a car, you go to a car company. You want shoes, you go to a shoe company. You want insurance, you go to an insurance company. You want investments, you go to an investment company. Don't go to an insurance company for investments. Let me tell you. Well, don't worry. We'll skewer insurance agents. I'm one of them. Remember, I'm a licensed agent eventually. And what the investment company does is it invests the shareholders' money in a diversified portfolio of securities. And so you get two wonderful things that are difficult, not impossible, but difficult for an individual investor to get on their own. You get professional money management. These are people whose job it is to do investments. Do you build your own car? Make your own shoes? No, they are professionals that are doing that for you. And the same thing is true for mutual funds. And then, as we'll see, the mutual fund can diversify amongst many alternatives. For an individual, 10, 20 stocks, that's a lot to keep track of for one individual. But when you have entire teams of analysts and professional money managers, portfolio counselors, portfolio managers, then they can own 100, 200 stocks. Right, because they have entire teams to do that. Each fund has a specific objective, and there are almost 12,000 funds to choose from. What? Piano, are you serious? I mean, you go into a grocery store and you walk down the aisle. Are there 12,000 different breakfast cereals? It kind of seems that way. No. Are there 12,000 different kinds of cars out there? No. But why is that? Well, we're going to discuss various reasons for that as we go through these presentations. And so hopefully it'll start to make sense especially when we get to the various types of mutual funds. And as we started our discussion here, many people choose mutual funds for their retirement accounts, 401ks, 403bs, traditional and Roth IRAs. Now, if you don't know what these are, don't worry. Relax. They're not that complicated. They're dumb names. I don't know where they got. Oh, I know where they got the name 401k, 403b. It comes from the Internal Revenue Code. But what a dumb name, right? 401k. And so we go to the IRS and we say, can't you come up with a better name? And they say, oh, yeah, we call them salary reduction agreements. Ooh, that's what I want, a salary reduction. All right. Anyway, we'll discuss these in detail later on. In fact, one of these, it's actually the federal employees 401k, is one of your assignments for Chapter 4. And it's actually a very well-run 401k plan. Well done, government. So Remember, when they do things dumb, we like to yell at them, but when they do smart things, we want to give them kudos. So let's take a look at the graph on slide number 3. Now, I want you to be very proud of me. I did this graph all by myself. Here we are. We're the little people. And we give our $50, $100 a month or more, if we can afford it, to the people in the top hats. And here they are, folks. These are the research analysts. These are the portfolio counselors, the portfolio managers. And notice that more of the investors, more and more of the investors and the portfolio counselors are women. That's a woman. It's good. This is good. Why? Because it turns out that women make better investors than men. It's already been statistically shown. We'll discuss that later on. And they create this pool of money. Now, I know it looks kind of like a potato, but it's supposed to be a pool of money. And there are millions of people giving billions of dollars to these pools of money. And so the portfolio managers, when they go out and buy stocks, they don't buy 10, 20. They buy 100 or 200 or more. Same thing is true. When they go out and buy bonds, they buy 100 bonds. So that if one company goes belly up, bankruptcy, then your stock or bond mutual fund does not fall into the porcelain oasis. If they invest in short-term securities that we discussed in the previous chapter, then it's called a money market mutual fund. But typically, the mutual fund disappears, and you hear people say money market. Now, what we begin to see here is the bifurcation. You like that word? It's a fancy word for splitting up of mutual funds. A balanced mutual fund invests in both stocks and bonds. And we'll discuss this explosion of mutual funds in a subsequent presentation. Slide number 4. The industry is huge, dear students. It is outrageously large. And again, as we've said already, and we'll say again, there's a future for you if you want to work for a mutual fund company. Now, there are maybe one or two mutual fund companies left in San Diego, not too many, but they're all over the country. And if you're not tied to living in San Diego, that there's a future for you working for a mutual fund company itself. In 1940, when the Investment Company Act of 1940 was created, there were already 70 mutual funds. 30 years later, 350, I'm sorry. In 1980, 600, and then look, in the 1980s and 90s, the stock market went in two directions, up and way up, and we saw 2,000 in 1990 and 9,000 by the year 2000. Since then, the growth has moderated, but still, we're almost up to 12,000 mutual funds. Pretty amazing. And why? We'll discuss that as we go along. Now, if you are the kind of person who just loves statistics, I want you to consider taking a look at ICI.org. This is the Investment Company Institute. It's a trade organization. It's a nonprofit. It's funded by the mutual fund companies themselves. And the data there is just overwhelming. It's every year they come out with their yearbook, their mutual fund yearbook. It comes out about May, and it shows the year before. So I know I'm a little different than most people, but I look forward every year to May when I can download the latest copy of the mutual fund yearbook and just sit. I told you I can talk about this stuff a lot longer than most. Any reasonable person would ever want to listen. And so this data is all from the ICI annual yearbook. Slide number 5. In 1980, 5 million Americans owned mutual funds, holding just 3% of their household financial assets. But as of December 2017, almost 102 million Americans in 57.3 million households own mutual funds, and that's almost half. Literally, that's every other, almost, not quite, every other household in this country owns mutual funds. That's a pretty astounding figure. And the assets now totaled, as of December 2017, $22.4 trillion, with a T, dear students. That's 24% of the household's financial assets. Now, we're not including real estate in this. We're talking about securities, financial assets. And mutual funds are now the nation's largest financial intermediary. It means they hold other people's money, followed by the banks, and then the life insurance companies. Huh? The life insurance companies? Yes, they're often called the invisible bankers, and they sure would love to hold on to your money, as the banks love to, and so do the mutual fund companies. But who does you the best, in my humble opinion? The mutual fund companies, assuming they're good mutual fund companies, as we'll see. Not all of them are that great. Slide number six. Here is a recent growth of the mutual fund assets. And I go back to 2007 because what I'd like you to see is what happened in 2008. Right? We were at $13 trillion before the Great Recession reared its ugly head, and then down to $10.4 trillion. But again, we didn't run, we didn't hide, right, dear students? We believed that the world, the United States, and the world was going to come back, and you know, we're going to have another Great Recession someday. We might not call it the Great Recession, but it's going to happen, maybe sooner than later. But still, we see that the growth has been fairly steady, and we're up to $22.4 trillion. And this, as we'll discuss, the different types of funds, open-end, closed-end, and exchange-traded funds. We'll discuss that in a moment. Now, what are some of the advantages of mutual funds? Remember, every investment has advantages. Every investment has disadvantages. Well, as we said, you get two wonderful things. You get diversification. This process allows investors to buy into a diversified portfolio of securities for their collective benefit, which, as we said, it's not impossible, but it just ain't easy for an individual investor to have a broadly diversified portfolio. And so with $100, you can buy 25 cents of Apple and 50 cents of Ford and 25 cents of Medtronic. And if one company goes belly up, it's not going to destroy your portfolio. We also get the professional money management, where these people in the top hats are supposed to know what they're doing. They're certainly getting paid well enough. Well, some are very, very good, dear students, and some not so good. And that's the hard part for us mutual fund investors, is to ferret out or have an financial advisor help us find the mutual funds that we believe are going to do well over the long term. And there, as we've already made reference to this, you don't need a whole lot of money. $25, $50 a month, they're usually happy to set up automatic payment from your checking account, from your payroll. There are some mutual funds that say, we want at least $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 for you to invest. But, dear students, you don't want those mutual funds. Those tend to be more specialized, more concentrated, dangerous, more risky, in other words. And so you want a broadly based mutual fund. And we'll discuss types of mutual funds in a subsequent presentation. Okay, so $50 a month. Can you afford that? Some people say, oh, I can't afford to invest. It's like, how much is your cell phone payment, huh? Oh, yeah, $50 a month. Okay. Now, the last one, which I wish I had come up with, and I didn't. I wish I did, because it's such a great name, is the PETA Factor. That's the wealthy barber, David Chilton. Pain in the... yeah, right. Once you've chosen your mutual fund, and that alone is a big pain right there. That's the painful part. But once you've chosen your mutual fund or mutual funds, or through the help of a financial advisor, it's easy, folks. It's very, very, there's nothing for you to do. Just keep making sure you put your $50, $100 a month away every month. You know, keep track of them every 6 months, every 3 months, maybe. But for the most part, you forget about them, because that's their job. Assuming you've purchased a prudent, long-term oriented mutual fund that has both risk and return in their lexicon, in their consciousness. Now, what are the drawbacks? Because nothing's perfect, dear students, right? Nothing is perfect, including mutual funds. And what we find is that mutual funds charge fees. Well, yeah, they're not in this for their health. They're out to make a buck, just as everybody else, because they need to buy food, clothing, and shelter, and internet access. And this is one of the things that people tend not to understand, or don't even want to try to understand it. So this is one of the things you, dear students, as students of Business 123, Introduction to Investments, are going to understand upside down, left side, right, because I'm going to drill it into your heads. Some mutual funds charge what's called a sales load, a sales commission, a sales fee. It's an upfront fee, sometimes a back-end fee, sometimes a yearly fee that goes to the advisor, right? But other people say, you know what, I want a no-load fund. I don't want to have to pay that commission. So they usually then decide the mutual fund on their own or through the help of an advisor who hides the fee somewhere else. But a no-load fund may wind up costing you more in fees over time than a load fund. How is that? Because every mutual fund charges annual operating expenses. And there ain't no way to get around that. Because they gotta, you know, they gotta pay the people who are doing the research. They have to pay the rent, the lights, all the accounting and the computer systems that they have, all the research they do. It's not cheap if it's done well. So expect to pay anywhere from about 0.5% up to about 1.5%. Now there are mutual funds that charge a whole lot more than that. You may find that they're the mutual fund for you, but I try to stay away from mutual funds like that. And there are some mutual funds that charge a whole lot less. How do they get away with that? Ah, we will discuss that in our next presentation. They don't do any research. Figure that one out. And then, many mutual funds don't match the market's performance. What? Aren't the mutual fund managers supposed to know what they're doing? Well, yes. And some do a very, very good job. And some don't do a very, very good job. And some are simply victims of the arbitrary nature of mutual fund, of market indices. You know, a company that is tied to this one index, and we're going to discuss indexes later on. I know it's one of the reasons why it's a good idea to have mutual funds after stock market, after doing stocks and bonds, because you understand what the indices are. But some mutual funds, they don't match well with their index, and so they either outperform it wildly or they underperform it wildly, and people say, why can't you match your index? Because our strategy is not the same as that index, which is just a list of stocks, dear students. That's all it is. It's just a list of stocks that somebody came up with. So we'll discuss this in detail as we move through the semester, because it's a very important thing that you must be able to explain to your friends and family, because you're going to be the guru, right, for your friends and family. Slide number 9. Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the different types of mutual funds from a very overarching categories. And those categories are closed-end, open-end, and then ETFs, exchange-traded funds. For decades, there were two types of funds, open-end and closed-end funds. And open-end funds are by far the more popular. They comprise about 80% of all mutual funds. This is a mutual fund, an investment company, in which investors buy shares from and sell them back to the mutual fund company itself. There's no limit on the number of shares that the company can issue. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of investors. You give them some money, they poof, create these shares and give them to you, and then you say, I want my money back, they poof, sell those shares and they disappear. That's how it works. Mutual funds are continually creating new shares and when investors pay them money, when investors contribute, and then they're destroying those shares when the investors redeem, when they ask for their money back. And When people refer to a mutual fund, unless they say closed-end or ETF, exchange-traded fund, they're almost always exclusively referring to open-end mutual funds. And notice, as of December 17th, there were 9,300 of these things, 9,356 open-end mutual funds, totaling almost $19 trillion of assets. So they are the big gorilla. Closed-end mutual funds are a different type of mutual fund, and they are becoming less and less popular. Notice that they're less than 5% of all mutual funds. The closed-end mutual fund just issues a set number of shares, 10 million shares or 20 million shares. And then the shares are issued when the fund is organized to initial investors. After all the original shares are sold, then you have to buy them from another investor. So in this way, they look like a stock. They look like a bond, when we'll discuss how stocks and bonds are traded later on. But you incur brokerage commissions because you have to find another investor, and that's what brokers do. They find you another investor who holds those shares of that mutual fund or stock or bond, and then you buy them from them. And the same thing is true when you want to sell it. So closed-end mutual funds, because they're not as flexible as mutual fund, as open-end mutual funds, are just not as popular. They are becoming fewer and fewer as the years go by. As of 2017, December 2017, there were only 530 of these, as opposed to, you know, thousands of the open-end mutual funds. And they were only holding $275 billion in assets, whereas the, you know, the open-end mutual funds are holding almost $19 trillion. And as we said, the numbers, both of these numbers, the assets and the number of closed-end mutual funds, are shrinking. But then, you know, it doesn't mean there aren't good ones out there, but they're a bit of a dying breed. The net asset value on slide number 11 is the underlying value. Now, most people won't call it the net asset value. They'll just look at the price of the mutual fund. But that's what it's actually called. The price of the mutual fund is the net asset value. And every day at the close of the market, the open-end mutual funds must go out there and find out what the underlying value of one of their shares is. They add up the value of all the securities in the mutual fund, and they subtract any liabilities, which, in other words, you got to pay the rent, you got to pay some investors off, you have to pay payroll, and then you divide that by the number of shares. Open-end mutual funds are sold at the net asset value, with a sales load added to the load funds, if there's a sales charge. But since closed-end mutual funds are bought and sold on the open market, their price usually either reflects a discount, a premium, or a discount, usually a discount, to the net asset value. So you see, just because the net asset value is $10 doesn't mean that's what it's trading at. Somebody might say, I'll give you $10.20 for it. Somebody might say, I'll give you $9.80 for it. So open-end mutual funds are always bought and sold at their net asset value, and then if there's a sales charge, they add that on top of it. But closed-end mutual funds are at the whim of the marketplace. Once all the shares have been sold to investors, then it's up to the supply and demand. Does this make sense? If not, go back and listen to it again. And if it still doesn't make sense, don't worry about it. Just make sure you understand what a open-end and a closed-end mutual fund. And then when we get to stocks, where we'll see the supply and demand dynamic going about day to day, that'll make more sense. Now, here's the formula, which I'm not going to ask you to do it, but it's actually pretty darn simple. The value of the fund's portfolio, they go out every day. Every day the market is open and then closes at 4 o'clock New York time, 1 o'clock our time. They run around and find out what the value of, what the price of each security they own, stock or bond or whatever. And then they multiply that by how many shares they have. And that's the value of the fund's portfolio. They then subtract out any liabilities. As we said, you know, payroll, we have to pay off these investors, we have to pay the rent for the building. And then divide that by the number of shares. So say you had a mutual fund that had securities worth $10,050,000 and they had to pay somebody $50,000. That would be $10 million. You divide that by 1 million shares and you get $10. So that would be the net asset value. And again, you're not going to hear people say net asset value. They're just going to say, what's the price of the mutual fund? And then if there's a sales commission, we would add that to the offering price. And that's if it has a sales load. Those are the open-end mutual funds that have sales loads. Cool? Okay. Don't worry. I'm not going to ask you to do this calculation. It's done for you every day. Slide number 13. What are the advantages and disadvantages of each? Well, open-end mutual funds are just so much more popular. There's so many more choices. You don't have to worry about supply and demand. But there's a problem. It's not the problem of the investor. It's the problem of the mutual fund. If a mutual fund becomes very popular because they've done very well, what's going to happen? You know what's going to happen. People are going to start shoving more and more money at it. And then all of a sudden, now the company says, well, what are you going to do with these extra $1 billion? You know, we've already bought all the stocks that we want to buy or the bonds we want to buy. And so it can make the management of the fund difficult. And for this reason, sometimes mutual funds will close a fund, a very popular fund. And you say, hey, check out this fund. It's really good. And you go to look and it says, sorry, we're closed. No new investors wanted. The same problem happens on the downside. If the mutual fund doesn't do well, people start pulling their money out, and now the open-end mutual fund has to redeem those shares. They have no choice. I mean, they have to do it. And so now they have to start pulling money out. They might have to sell investments that they don't want to sell. So open-end mutual funds are a little harder to manage from the viewpoint of the mutual fund company itself. Now, some mutual funds have various ways of dealing with this, such as closing the fund. Others simply add more capacity. They add more mutual fund managers and the like. So there's ways of getting around that. But you don't have this problem in the closed-end world. Why? Because there's only so many shares. There's only 10 million shares or 1 million shares out there. The closed-end mutual fund company doesn't have to worry about large redemptions or large purchases. They don't have to worry about it. It's just not there. But as we said, closed-end mutual funds are not that popular. There's not that many choices. You have to pay the broker's commission as if you were buying a stock, and then there's a premium or a discount to the net asset value. So they're just not that popular. And I ask, what would you or what do you prefer? And you decide. But chances are you're not going to be goofing with closed-end mutual funds. Doesn't mean you shouldn't, but you very rarely see any in 401ks. You just don't see them. They just don't. I've never seen one. Slide number 14. Now, the new kid on the block who is flexing his muscles, her muscles, and becoming very, very powerful. And these are called exchange-traded funds. Normally, you'll hear people say ETF. And currently, they're about 16% of mutual funds. These are a hybrid. They are an open-end mutual fund, which means there's no limit to the number of shares, but they trade on the stock exchanges like a closed-end mutual fund. So they have one foot in one world, they have another foot in the other world. There's no limit. Shares are redeemed and purchased as needed, but you don't buy them through the mutual fund company. You buy them as if you were a stock investor. You buy them on the exchanges, which we'll discuss in next chapter when we get to stocks. But now what happens? If you buy them on an exchange, you have to use a brokerage account. You have to pay a commission. Ha ha ha. Mutual fund company. You know, some of these companies are pretty darn smart. You may have heard of Fidelity and Vanguard, and we'll take a look at them later on. Both of them now have sister companies, which are brokerage companies. They have the same name, but they're not the exact same company. They're brokerage. I forget what Fidelity calls themselves and Vanguard's brokerage firm. I forget the names, but you just remember Vanguard. You remember Fidelity. And there are others. They're not the only ones. And they offer ETFs. And if you buy their exchange-traded funds through their brokerage firm, they waive the commission. Is that smart or what? Yeah, it is. In other words, hey, buy our ETFs through our brokerage firm, and we will not charge you a commission. So this was one of the things that kept people from, you know, buying $50 a month of an ETF, because you're going to pay $7 or $12 or whatever for a commission. But now, if you buy it through their company, you can do it just like an open-end mutual fund. You don't have to pay any commission. So very, very smart marketing. Fidelity, by the way, those of you who are business majors and want to learn about companies and the history of the companies and how they adapted and fought threats, opportunities, strategies, strengths, weaknesses, check out both these companies. They're both very interesting in how they've fought back and forth over the last 30 some odd years or so, 40 years. Because forever, Fidelity was the largest mutual fund company, and then Vanguard has displaced them. So check them out, those of you who are business fans. Slide number 15. Notice that the ETF industry is exploding. 2006, there were 359 funds with $423 billion. And then notice the little drop here, even though the number of funds is going up exponentially in 2008. Yeah, right. But then look at what happened. We're now up to almost 2,000 ETFs with $3.4 trillion. So almost a tenfold increase in the amount of money coming in, and a what, sixfold increase or so? Not quite. No, four and a half fold increase in the number of ETFs. Yes, ETFs are becoming very, very popular, and there are people who say, "Oh, you should only go with an ETF." Well, that's, you know, silly. Some are great, some are not so great, and that's true of open-end and closed-end funds. You know, everybody's different. And we do our research and we decide whether this is for us or not. And we'll discuss the advantages that ETFs have over, and the disadvantages over, open-end and closed-end mutual funds. It's actually it's called actively managed versus passively managed. And we'll discuss this later on in detail, so don't get too bent out of shape if you don't know what I just said. Slide number 16. How are mutual funds regulated? Well, they are heavily regulated, dear students. You see, the Investment Company Act of 1940 set in stone the mutual fund industry. Before this, there were mutual funds, but the regulators and the laws had not caught up to them yet. Sound familiar? You know, we're having the same problem. Technology races ahead and the government can't keep up with it. But here's an example of the Republic rats and demagogues getting together in the sandbox and playing nicely and creating a piece of legislation that has stood the test of time. You see, before the Investment Company Act of 1940, mutual funds were looked at with a very wary, skeptical eye by the regulators and the IRS. They'd say, "Wait a minute, you're a company, you're making money, you have to pay us taxes." And the mutual fund company said, "No, you don't understand. No. We're holding on to somebody else's money. We're doing the investment for somebody else. Go tax them. They're the ones who are actually making the money." And the IRS said, let's see what we can do about this. So the Investment Company Act of 1940 defined a regulated investment company. That's the legal term. Remember, we said investment company is a legal term, which is a pass-through investment vehicle. The company, the mutual fund itself, doesn't pay any taxes. And any money they make from their fees, they have to pay taxes on that. But on the sale, the buying and selling of stocks and bonds and the dividends and the interest and all that, they pass that through to the shareholders. Does that make sense? Yes, it does. But at the time, we weren't sure what to do with these things. So to qualify, an investment company must hold almost all their assets in stocks, bonds, other traditional securities. They have very limited ability to use those risky strategies, derivatives and the like that we discussed for just a few moments in Chapter 1 and we'll discuss at the end of the semester. And so, in other words, stocks are risky enough. You don't have to be doing much more risky things for the masses, for the vast, you know, for the hoi polloi out there. You want to make sure that you're staying fairly, you know, middle of the road investments. And you must not use more than 5% of your assets when acquiring a particular security. Now, what does this mean? Well, it means you can't buy one company. You can't just say, okay, I'll be a mutual fund and I'm going to buy Apple or Microsoft or Ford or GM. You have to buy at least 20 companies because 5% divided into the 100% means 20, right? So you got to have at least 20 stocks or 20 bonds. Now, very few mutual funds have that few stocks or bonds. They might have 100, they might have 200. But the idea is we're going to enforce diversification. Does that make sense? I hope so. Now, also, you must create an organization with checks and balances. So you civic students, your government students will know what checks and balances are, or are supposed to be. They used to be around, but not so much anymore. The idea is we don't want somebody playing fast and loose with the rules and running away with the money, right? We want it to be heavily regulated. And so here is a graph that I think should really be turned upside down. I think the shareholders should be at the bottom, but they put them at the top. And there's a board of directors of the mutual fund, of which 75% must not work for the mutual fund company. They have to be independent. And their job is to oversee the fund, to make sure that it's being run in the best interest of the shareholders. Now, some of these boards of directors have been accused of being nothing more than a rubber stamp. And whatever the mutual fund says, they just say, okay, you know, fine with us. But, you know, that's changing. Some have always been very strict and always overseen their mutual funds very prudently and with an eye towards the best interest of the shareholders. So, again, it's a mixed bag. And then you have the mutual fund itself. Now, I'm not sure exactly what this bar is supposed to mean, but the mutual fund is not a single entity. It is made up of several entities. The most important, of course, being the investment advisor, the management company. These are the people with the top hats. These are the people who make the decisions based upon the fund's objectives and strategies. Is it a stock mutual fund? Is it an aggressive growth fund? Is it a bond mutual fund? Is it a defensive bond fund? So we'll discuss all these different strategies as we go along. But do they hold on to the assets? No. They make the decisions, but a custodian, often a bank or a trust company, they're the ones who actually hold on to the shares. You see? So the investment advisor can't run away with the shares. The bank or the trust company has it. And then there's a distributor that actually is responsible for going out to the public and selling the shares to the public or through brokerage firms or other intermediaries, banks and the like, but usually brokerage firms. The transfer agent is the company that's responsible for actually doing the buying and selling of the fund shares to the public. Their job is to actually do the bookwork. And then there's an independent public accountant, usually one of the big accounting firms, PricewaterhouseCoopers, Ernst & Young, Deloitte & Touche, KPMG. You accounting fans might have heard of these companies. And their job is to make sure that everything's being done on the up and up, right? the investment advisor says, hey, we bought 100,000 shares of Motorola. And the independent public accountant says, okay, where are they? And they go to the custodian, and the custodian says, here they are. They're sitting in this account over here. Make sense? Yeah. And so the next couple of slides are basically that same graph in text form. The mutual fund is the corporation run by the board of directors on behalf of the shareholders. you get to vote for your shareholders. Most people don't know what they're voting for. They just send the thing in and say, yeah, okay, fine with me. The investment advisor is the also called the management company, is made up of portfolio managers, sometimes called portfolio counselors, sometimes a team or a committee, and then research analysts who usually focus on a specific industry. These are the people with the top hats. The distributors, as we said, are the folks who distribute the shares to the public or through dealers. And we'll discuss the role of investment bankers and initial public offerings in Chapter 5 when we get to stocks. But essentially, a mutual fund is continually regenerating and sending itself out, sending out the shares to the world. So they must always say, hey, you know, here we are. Here's our prospectus. Here's our annual report. This is what we're doing. And then the custodian, we said, holds on to the securities. Yes, a bank or a trust company often. The transfer agent keeps track of the purchases and redemption requests from shareholders. And then the independent public accounting firm certifies the fund's financial reports. So that's basically what we discussed a couple slides ago. But why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Well, dear students, mutual funds are highly regulated in order to protect shareholders' investments from fraud and collapse. How often have you heard of a scandal at a mutual fund company, huh? Well, in 2003, you never heard of... Wait a minute, Piano! Did you just say mutual fund scandals? You want me to invest in an industry that is plagued with scandal? Well, yes, as a matter of fact. You know, you see, since 1940, since the Investment Company of Act of 1940, the mutual fund industry has been heavily regulated and escaped any hint of impropriety. You like that word, impropriety? It means hanky-panky, travesuras, trucos. And in 2003, some practices that were not quite illegal, but obviously unethical, were uncovered. It was, folks, it was only a handful of firms, a handful of people. But they were doing things that, you know, they weren't illegal, but they were basically stealing from their fellow mutual fund shareholders, which is not right. And some of them were strongly thwacked. And the one was the guy who ran Strong Funds. He started it from scratch. He was worth $600 million at the time. And he was stealing slices of pennies from his fellow shareholders. And why would somebody who's worth $600 million, he made about $80,000 in ill-gotten gains, and why would somebody do that? To you and me, $80,000, that's a lot of money, but to him it was pocket change. And he himself said, I was stupid. I started to believe everything that people told, all the wonderful things they said about me, that I was invincible, that I could do anything. And I just felt that I was above the law. And you know, he was very contrite, very sorry. They banned him from the industry for life. And he said, I've let all the people who love me and admire me down. And I deserve it. Yeah, stupid. Janus, Bank of America had mutual funds that were involved. Putnam, poor George Putnam, rolling in his grave that his company almost disappeared. Strong did disappear. They got bought up by somebody else. But Putnam, they thought it was going to disappear, but it got purchased by somebody else, but it's still around. It's a good company, folks. They got some very good funds. And then Alliance. Poor Alliance. Two people, folks. There were two people in the entire Alliance Mutual Fund company that were doing this, and it was thought that Alliance was going to disappear. What happened is they merged with another company called Bernstein. And then it was called Alliance Bernstein, and now it's called AB. Figure that one out. But they have some great funds. In fact, we're going to take a look at one of their funds in the next chapter. So it was very, very sad. But as we said, the vast majority of companies never engaged in any of these shenanigans. And you're probably thinking, well, Piano, what did they do? Well, it's a little tricky. It's hard to explain. But I'll try to give you the real quick example. You're a mutual fund, and every day at 4 o'clock in New York, you have to, when the market closes, you have to go in there and get all the prices of the securities around the world, and create the net asset value, right? Well, say the market tanks in New York. It goes down 1 or 2%. And it closes and at 4 o'clock. A couple of hours later, it's going to open up in Japan. Now, those prices at 4 o'clock New York time are stale for Japan. Because it was yesterday in Japan. Now it's today in Japan, which is tomorrow for us. Figure that one out. And so Japan's market is probably going to open up down. So what do? You sell your Japanese fund on that current day when the market closes at 4 o'clock New York time. And then you anticipate that the Japanese market's going to fall, and it often does, not always, but the markets are more and more in step with one another globally because the world is global. Don't tell that to Mr. Trump. The world is global. And so to the next day, the Japanese market falls. You then turn around and buy back your Japanese fund. See, it will fall, 20 cents or whatever, but you'll be able to profit from a very quick sale and then repurchase of your mutual funds. Now, this was not illegal at the time, but it certainly was unethical. It wasn't right. You were basically stealing pennies from your fellow investors. And now you can't do this. I mean, most mutual funds before that wouldn't let you do this. Some mutual funds, like American, if you did that, they would say, don't do that. And if you did it again, they'd say, we want you to leave. We don't want you as an investor. They'll just tell you not to do it. Others, and Vanguard did the same thing. Vanguard would say, don't do that. We don't want you as an investor if you're going to do that. Mutual funds are long-term investments. Other mutual fund companies are a little trickier. They say, okay, you can do that. But if you do, if you sell it and then buy it back within 30 days or whatever, 60 days, we're going to charge you 2%. Go right ahead. Go make a 0.5%. But we'll charge you 2% and we'll give it to your fellow shareholders. You see what they're doing? They're discouraging you from playing trading because mutual funds are long-term investments. You're not supposed to do this. Now, this is one of the things you can do with ETFs. I don't want to get too much into this because I fear I might be confusing you. But this is one of the things you can do with an ETF. You can trade it throughout the day, whereas you should never be able to do that with mutual funds. They're not meant to be trading vehicles, and some people were doing that. Okay, so did I confuse you enough? I apologize if I did. Go back, listen to it again. Make sure you know the difference between a open end, a closed end, and then the hybrid ETF exchange-traded funds. Make sure you understand what a mutual fund is and how the companies have grown and the industry has exploded, and then how the companies are regulated to protect you, the investor. And in our next presentation, we will go into great detail about the aspect of mutual funds that most people just don't want to even believe exists. You know what I'm talking about. Fees, right? So you're going to be the subject matter expert. You're going to be the investment guru for your friends and family and coworkers, and they are going to be so darn impressed. I'm already so proud of you. Keep up the great work. Study hard. Bring honor and glory to Southwestern College. Dear students, we want you to be awesome.